You're listening to Face Off, Episode 16, recorded Sunday, April 26th, 2009. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us via Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right, Mark, we actually don't have any news or follow-ups today, so let's just dig right into the web apps.
All right, the first web app we got is FeedStitch.
What FeedStitch is the name is pretty self-explanatory, except for, not really. I kind of lied. It's not FeedStitch. What it does is you create an account there, and you add a bunch of different feeds, and you can then group them into one feed.
Really?
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of services do this already, but this is the only one I found that does specifically this, just RSS feeds.
So instead of, I guess, having a folder of maybe like security feeds, you could take a couple different feeds and stitch them into one feed and just follow the one.
And just call it security. You know, that way you don't have to, you know, I'm really bad about RSS. Like, it stresses me out. I don't know why, but if I go in RSS and I see like 168 items, but and they're all spread out, I'm just like, Mark is red. Yeah, exactly. So this is a way, like you said, you can group them together. Or like what I did, there's some services that do this, like Friend Feed and whatnot. But I went in and I added Face Off feed. I added my jaderobbins.com feed. I added my Montana Fragfest feed. You know, my Flickr uploads and my Twitter feed to make a Jade Robbins RSS feed.
Okay.
You know, kind of like, I don't know if you follow Leo Laporte, he has all his various, all his different sort of shows with their own feed. But then he also has what he calls Radio Leo, which is just every episode from any show or any public appearance he did at all.
Is it a public URL? Could you say, these are the feeds I watch if you want to follow them?
No. But, you know. No. But you can see...
It's got to be. You got to be able to have to give it a URL.
The feed itself is, the feed is public. I mean, you can give out the feed URL, but there isn't like a page that says, this is the feeds that make up this feed.
Oh, okay.
Which is what I thought you wanted. No. So.
Okay, well, but you could share, you could say, I mean, if you want to follow the feeds that I follow, there's a link.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, let's say you don't use something like Google Reader, which segments all your different feeds. Let's say you just have something that kind of wants one feed, like a widget on a website, like an RSS widget. You know, it doesn't want multiple RSS feeds. It just wants one, and it'll display items from it. Well, then this is a way to sneak around. You can bind all your stuff into one and then give it that RSS feed.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, and they got...
Is it easy to use? I mean, easy to add feeds?
It's really easy to use. I'm looking at it right now. I select the feed type. They have just regular RSS, but then they also have some built-in services like Twitter, Picasa, or Flickr, Delicious, GitHub, and then Twitter search, and you just put it in there, hit add feed, and then what you do is you've added all your feeds, then you group them into a stitched feed.
See, I actually follow a few keywords on the search.twitter. This would be nice to just combine all those.
Exactly.
And say, this is like, Linux stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Linux search keyword.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of having like five different feeds.
Instead of having like Twitter searches for Linux, Twitter searches for Ubuntu, Twitter searches for this, you can combine them all into just Twitter search for Linux stuff.
Okay.
So
I like their cool. Their company name is Pointless Corp.
Yeah, they seem like a cool company. They have a really kind of cool, nice design, really easy on the eyes, big type, which actually. I have to admit, my vision seems to be getting worse as I get older, and I like big type a lot more. Small type hurts my eyes. So check them out, feedstitch.com.
Okay, what do we got next?
All right, the next thing I want to talk about is called lessaccounting.com, and I've heard a lot of buzz about these guys. I'm going to be full disclosure here. I haven't actually used them, but I've heard a lot of good things about them, so I kind of want to talk about their service. Their service makes sense. I just haven't had a chance to really sign up for it yet, and I should look at it. What Less Accounting does is they call it stress-free accounting. Save time and frustration. Stop trying to learn QuickBooks.
Okay.
So if you go to their website and you see the tour, they have a lot of videos showing you what they can do. So some of the things they talk about is like a big money dashboard, which makes sense. Any real app, web app these days has a dashboard that gives you a quick overview of what, you know, is going on in your account.
Okay.
You can watch money, you know, run and view exports, including transactions, profit and loss, mileage payable, payroll, receivable, sales tax. You can run all these kind of reports that you're going to need in your business.
So it looks like you can track who owes you money and things.
Yeah, money out, you know, track your expenses, log your vehicle mileage and transfer funds, properly track your business expenses and mileage, money in, create and organize, send your invoices, proposals, deposits, and payments. If you create a proposal, you can then just change that to an invoice with a click of a button and send out an invoice for it. So, you know, this project's getting ready to go.
So it actually has, like, proposal generation. I mean, you can have, like, a report for proposals.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So
it's kind of like Billing Boss a little bit then?
Kind of like Billing Boss, but it's supposed to be, it's kind of like if you took Billing Boss and Mint and, you know, a couple other things and just mushed them into one thing for your business. Cool. It would give you that. It has CRM, you know, so you have contact management, things like that for your whole company.
I like how you can invite your accountant to come check your stuff out or export your data to them.
Yeah.
Sales taxes. It looks, by the picture, I'm assuming it has an iPhone or, you know, iPod.
It looks
app.
Like an iPhone app, and you know like how that. Much I love that. Yeah, exactly.
So this isn't a free service, right? This is something you're going to pay for. Is that right?
You know, I didn't even.
I mean, look
at the pricing aside up at the top. Yeah. So, no, there is a free account.
There is one.
But you have limited use of invoices and expenses and accounting reports. There's a basic one.
Oh, there is a freebie one.
There's a lot. There's five different ways you can do it. There's an even less, which has unlimited use of invoices, expenses, limited reports, and tech support. And then like $20 a month, experienced freelancers. You know, they kind of tell you what you should have. Uh-huh. So like experienced freelancers and small business, you know, even less functions, proposals, mileage log, deposits, bank accounts. And for $24 a month, the full gamut of features.
Bank reconciliation.
Multiple types of sales tax. It seems like a really smart, and the guys that did this, I've seen a couple articles. They're really forward thinking, trying to do cool stuff. And it makes sense. I mean, if a good chunk of becoming a business is learning QuickBooks, that doesn't sound right. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of businesses that have no that have no business being in QuickBooks. You know, the small business owner is trying to learn QuickBooks or just has no business being there. It's, you know, it's like, well, if you need all those advanced features, you probably should hire an accountant.
The other nice thing about that is QuickBooks, you have to be on that computer, the accounting computer, yeah. You know. With this, you can log in. You're on the road. You want to see some expenses. You can log in, check it out.
Yeah, I mean, you or I, if we had a company or something, you know, you stop at somewhere to eat lunch on your way here to Bozeman or something, you can get on the free Wi-Fi and open up your iPhone app and check it out.
Okay.
So it looks really cool. I think maybe you and I would like to see, maybe we can try this in the next week and report back on it. It seems, you know, because this is something you and I really kind of get into. We get into small business stuff. You know, business management, entrepreneurial things. So I'd like us to try this and see what we find out. But it looks like a really cool thing. I've heard a lot of good buzz about it. So I think people should check it out if you're looking for a solution. I mean, we talked about things like Billing Boss, which is just, you know, just an invoicing solution. There's a ton of CRM software out there, mm-hmm. Web-based, all over the place. And none of them seem to be good. But this integrates that for you. It's pretty affordable, yeah.
Okay.
And it's affordable. I mean... 24. If you're a small business, $24 a month is not bad.
Well, they take QuickBooks, I think, is $200 for one user.
Yeah.
So this, you could have multiple users log in.
Mm-hmm. Web based. I mean, you know,
you don't have to worry about installing stuff crashing.
Yeah. Viruses getting on your.
Virus or something.
Yeah, exactly. So check it out, lessaccounting.com.
Okay. And the next one we've got is PDF Me Not.
Yeah, so have you ever, there used to be a web application out there called Bug Me Not. Have you heard of it?
Yep.
It was a great little web app that basically gave you login accounts for various websites. Their whole point was saying, don't bug me with trying to register. You and I have talked about this a lot. A lot mm-hmm. of websites don't do this as much, but don't bother me with making me register. It got shut down because some people were using things like, you know, New York Times. They would get into articles that people who bought a subscription did, and so it got shut down. But they started something else called Retail Me Not, which is a great web application to get coupons. So you put in the web address of like the thing, you know, like Dell.com. They'll give you all the Dell coupons, kind of like a percentage success rate. Like if someone puts a coupon in, it doesn't work, they can say, no, this didn't work. And by default, it kind of filters out the flaky coupons. This is another one.
And it knows that by the URL that you're trying to buy it on?
Yeah, I mean, cool. You just put in like Dell.com, and you know, and when you, so let's say I'm going to buy, like I did this. I bought a monitor a couple months ago. I went to retail, and I said Dell.com, and I looked at what coupon codes I could get on there. So let's say I found a coupon code, and I decide, oh, I want to use that coupon code, you know, and then I just say, yeah, that worked, and then it gets a higher percent success rate, which means it's going to be, you know, at the top. Mm-hmm. And you can put in expiration dates and stuff like that for coupon.
Yeah, then you don't have to go searching around forums like Slick Deals and different things. You're on the site already, and you've got...
Yeah, exactly. So, that was kind of a whole web app in itself. Yeah. But from the same guys that did this, this is a really quick and easy one. It's called PDF Me Not. It's basically for people that are frustrated with having to open up another program to do a PDF. Or, you know, so what you do is you go to pfmenot.com, and there's you can either put a URL in, or you can browse it. You can upload a PDF. But either way, it just gives you a nice little web browser or web viewer to view the PDF.
Okay. A lot of times, like, the viewer, so everyone has their own kind of viewer a lot of times, and mm-hmm. you never know kind of, when you see a .pdf, sometimes it's going to, what is it going to do? Is it going to load up in my browser, or mm-hmm. is it going to save?
What's or, like, it do? That silly game of, like, I just want to see this PDF, I don't want to save it, I don't want to download right. it and view it on my computer.
And have to delete it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is just a quick, dirty way to do it. You know, things like Google Docs and Google itself now will let you view PDFs, but this is one that, you know, works for any of them. Just put the URL in, and it'll let you view it.
Okay.
And after, if you put the URL in, it's cached after the first view. It takes a little bit for the first time to process it, but after that, it's cached. So let's say there's a common PDF for a manual for something on, you know, like the iPhone manual or something. After that, that PDF is cached, and it'll load super quick.
Cool. It looks like they have a Firefox extension, too, so you probably integrate this to, like, every PDF open in this. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good call, probably. And that's smart. Because I just don't want to deal with that. I mean, sometimes at the end of the day, I look on my desktop and there's like 30 PDFs. Like if you ever do any system administration with like a machine room and you're looking for manuals online, you know, they never tell you the model number for the manual. So you end up downloading like 10 of them trying to figure out which one to get the manual to tell you this is the exact model of equipment I have. And then at the end of the day, you have 20 PDFs on your desktop and you're just like, So pdfmenot.com. All right, so for our topics today, the first topic we actually have is a little interview that we have with Eric Wendelin about the product Selenium. All right, today we have a special guest here. We actually have Eric Wendelin, who is here to talk to us about Selenium. So thank you for being on the show, Eric. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
All right, so let's start to dig right into it. And the first thing I kind of want to ask you is just, you know, what is Selenium and why would I use it?
Well, Selenium's a tool for automating web application testing. It comes in different flavors. There's an IDE, which is like a Firefox extension. It has a core piece that's included in the other ones. And then there's a Selenium remote control that you can use that includes its own server so that you can completely automate things. And then there are other ones that work with Rails and things. You know, really what you want to do with it is automate your web application testing, just how they describe on the website.
So is this a final or the last step in the integration testing, or is it more like the unit tests?
It's as high level as you can get for testing. It's really not like unit testing, but you can integrate it with that. Okay. But it really tests web interfaces. So Selenium runs in the browser. So it interacts with your web application just like a user would. And it tests the same thing. So, and it runs through JavaScript. So you can test whatever JavaScript can test.
Okay.
Oh, awesome. So when we, a couple episodes ago, we had Paul Levette in here. We talked about unit testing. And one of the things we tended to focus a lot on, like in the terms of an MVC, I guess we're not not really specifying this, but we talked about testing models, testing controllers, and we kind of really skimmed over the view testing. And you can do view testing with a normal testing suite, but this really looks at it as like instead of just saying is there does it do this, it looks at it from the viewpoint of a user interacting with your website, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
This is like automating the mouse clicks, filling in forms, making sure certain text shows up after a certain page is navigated. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay. How are tests formulated in Selenium?
Well, so usually people start out with the IDE, and like I said, it's a Firefox extension. And what that does is it uses the Firefox browser Chrome to inject the Selenium JavaScript into the page you're testing, which means that you can use the IDE to test, you know, Google.com or your website or whatever. Wow. And then you formulate tests by you can record with the IDE and play back. You know, the only caveat to the IDE is that it kind of has crappy XPath. And you know, just element selectors in general, which I might cover later, it's lacking, but for recording and playback and, you know, you can save your tests to different languages. You can also use, when you use Core, there's a sort of Selenium specific language, if you will, called Selenese, which is just HTML tables. And you would just basically each HTML table entry has a row with three columns, and the columns are, you know, an action, a locator, and then a value or something that, you know, that goes with the action. So you can have a click and then a locator for, you know, click this element, like a link that with this text.
Okay.
So, and then RC, you can write tests with whatever you want, and there's a client driver for your favorite language. I mean, there's a bunch of them: Python, Ruby, Java, and you could still write it in Selenese if you want. But the reason to do RC really is that, you know, I could integrate stuff with JUnit and write Java.
Yeah, yeah. You don't have to learn anything new. It kind of minimizes the learning curve on that. Okay, how are your results presented? Is it, you know, does it? I really should have played around with this a little bit more when we did it, but does it, you know, basically all the JavaScript, like, do the clicking? So, you know, do I load my Selenium and then say start the test, and like I can actually see it go like click and then wait and then, you know, click and drag, and then in the end, does it just give me like a big table that says these are the ones that passed, or how does it work?
Well, so when you're using Core, you start the browser session yourself. And then you basically, there's an automatic mode, and then there's kind of like a sort of manual-ish mode. And then when you run through it, it actually just, when you're with Core, it can save an HTML file with results. And then if you open up that HTML file in a browser, you know, it'll be green or red and tell you what parts of the test failed. With RC, it's really cool because you can integrate it with whatever other reporting you want. So if you're running JUnit, you can include the results of Selenium in your JUnit results. Well, you can also parse the Core files that it produces and, you know, create your own report. I've had people use Cobertura to like parse stuff and create their own little Selenium reports with Core. So,
it's
fairly pretty actually.
I could see someone using it to see if something is ever broken or something, and then maybe email you, or, you know, if something was critical.
Mm-hmm. That would be something more that's geared toward RC, and absolutely, yes. You can have it, and you can have a dashboard too, and see exactly what failed, and then dig into it from there.
That's really cool. It seems like it really sort of gives the disconnect. It kind of removes that disconnect of like regular unit testing that, I mean, we kind of look at GUIs and UIs and stuff with web pages and kind of say like, well, that's its own beast. And this, I mean, the fact that it can run as either a browser extension, but it's all JavaScript, makes it really, digs into that user interface and can allow you to do things that you wouldn't think would be normally or would be just really time intensive to do with pure scripting.
Yes, and also it's very key that it's JavaScript at its core, because JavaScript is very extendable. You can manipulate lots of stuff, you know, override prototype or whatever you want in JavaScript. And so if you want to write a little extension for a custom test or something, you can do it, and you don't have any code duplication or, you know, anything like that. So that's one of the powers, I think.
Okay, so how would someone get started with Selenium if, you know, they listen to this podcast and like, wow, Selenium sounds really cool. I wanna dig into it. How would we start that?
Well, first off, you can hit the website is seleniumhq.org. I'm sure that you guys have a link in the show notes. And, you know, it seems like the natural progression is to start out with the IDE and just try it out and, you know, test different selectors and, you know, try just navigating to through like Google search results. Mm-hmm. And then once you've gotten the hang of it, then you generally would, you know, download Core or the RC and set up the Selenium server. And then, I don't know, I guess you really have to look at the website to
sounds
to
like,
get started. They have very good verbiage there and examples.
Yeah, it sounds like the website is the way to go with that. Okay.
So does this support multiple browsers then, or is this just for Firefox?
Oh, no, it's any decent browser with decent JavaScript support will work with Core. RC is a little bit more difficult because you have to, you know, maybe Google Chrome might have security things in place that
I could definitely see that being a problem.
It's usually the case that just a subset of functionality is missing in any case. Mm-hmm. With Core, you know, Opera might have some JavaScript quirk that makes one function, one command in Selenium kind of fail or behave weirdly. But in general, you know, pretty much any A-grade browser, B-grade, I mean, supports from IE6 up, I believe.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So you could do just a myriad of just tons of different browser testing to make sure that it's
outputting.
And
that's the point, is that you don't, you know, want to have to run through the same tests in all these browsers by hand. I mean,
So you've written a lot of tests. What kind of things can you do with this? Can you give us examples of something that would be...
Oh my goodness!
You can test a lot of different things, but
some of the things that really helped you save time. What really helped you save time by using Selenium? I mean, like when I think about it, you know, cross browser testing seems to be the thing I would save the most time on. You know, maybe some AJAX testing, but some of the things that when you got done, you said, "Man, I am so glad I used Selenium on that instead of testing it all by hand." I mean, a good example, if you can, what you can, you know, sort of disclose that where you were really happy that you used Selenium to do all your testing.
Well, really, you know, testing on multiple browsers is the big thing. You already mentioned that.
Yeah.
Also, you know, there's just with these big web applications, there's just a ton of functionality. And if you have to, you know, redo your UI in, say, a different JavaScript framework, you have to retest everything.
Yeah. That's a great example, I think.
So I mean, we're maybe in the process of migrating something from, say, ZK to EXTJS, you know, JavaScript frameworks and stuff. And, you know, you have to test every single function, but you want to do it from the user level. And that's the best example of, you know...
That's an excellent example. I mean, I didn't even really think of that at all. That's another great thing. Like you said, it is JavaScript at its core, so it is a separate entity itself. I mean, it tests the functionality as the user sees it. It doesn't dig into the language behind it. It doesn't dig into what's powering it. All it knows is, as what the user knows, what the user is seeing is, can I click this? Will this happen? When I can I type this and this will happen?
Exactly.
That's a great example.
That is.
It should be noted that there are some things that it just certainly can't test. Like, there are some things that can just look wrong to a user.
Mm-hmm.
Selenium can really tell if an element exists, but it usually isn't used for where it is on the page.
Okay, yeah, I was going to
Does
ask
it look
that.
Pretty? There isn't a you know, does it if, look pretty test.
If you have some CSS that breaks your floats and you have some section of your website at the bottom and it shouldn't be there, only a human's really going to be able to see that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You can test that with Selenium, but that's just taking it a little bit too far. You have way too much time on your hands if you can write all those tests to make sure that it renders exactly as you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. If only they could make a testing suite that, you know, said, does it look good or does it work well? Just doesn't.
And until they have, you know, they extend it to include human eyes or something that just...
Object Selenium import. Extends brain.
Exactly.
Awesome. So Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That sounds really useful. It's unit testing in general, just testing in general, has really kind of blown my mind, as I mentioned back when we talked about just basic testing, because I mean, I personally have only worked on really small software projects. I'm assuming that you know, there's a lot of people out there that are doing big stuff where this is essential. But for me, as a kind of small time developer, this whole gamut of testing stuff has blown my mind, and especially just regular testing, I thought was, you know, the bee's knees. And then to find out that you can do, I mean, really, this is like the last level of testing that for a website. I mean, I'm really surprised by this. And Selenium sounds like a really easy easy way to do it. And like you said, the fact that you can do it and change frameworks and stuff makes it really useful. I don't know. Well, I mean, you've been working for a bigger company for a while now, and is just all sorts of unit testing and stuff, I mean, absolutely standard where you work?
It depends on what it is, to be honest. Some things, you know, are just command line oriented. On the web, it really depends on the priority of what it is, to be honest. In general, we try to test every single facet we possibly can. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, in a larger organization, priority could be that this gets done and shipped, unfortunately, instead of fully tested and just, you know, putting more pressure on QA.
Do you usually use it to test it like one time, or do you usually like run it every single day or something like that to make sure things that have not broken?
Ideally, we try to get it every day, have it run overnight. Mm-hmm. We don't use Selenium Grid quite yet, unfortunately. But
what is Selenium Grid?
Selenium Grid is basically Selenium RC, but you distribute the tests across multiple computers.
Oh, awesome.
So, you know, you could have one computer running IE and one running Safari and one running Chrome and one running Firefox. And it speeds up, you know, because these tests can take a long time, especially on the, I mean, you know, it's especially with IE, because IE, you realize, is extremely slow with this JavaScript execution, and especially XPath. So, So if you have a big application and a lot of tests, it can take forever. So, you know, for a full suite, you just let it, you know, kick it off when you leave and come back in the morning. Mm-hmm. But, you know, try to automate it so that it's just nightly. And hopefully nightly is good enough, because, I mean, what I mean is the whole night is long enough.
I mean, to test a whole suite on every different browser, I mean, that makes sense to use Grid to test test different browsers on different machines. That's a very clever idea.
Right, and it's not just different browsers. It'll split up tests, I'm sure, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the IE machine, you know, is just hanging there and the Firefox machine is done, it'll start IE up, you know, assuming that it's running Windows.
That was a really great overview. Thanks for helping us out, Eric. That was really great, because we were pretty green to the whole Selenium scene.
We were definitely excited about Selenium because it was something that was kind of new to us, but we didn't know a whole lot about it. I mean, I've used it a little bit. I've written a little bit in Perl. I wanted to do some Python, but the driver was for 2.5.
Oh, bummer.
And I was running
2.6. Well, I definitely encourage you guys to hit SeleniumHQ.org and download it and give it a shot, and then report back what you think.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to thank Eric for coming on the show and telling us a little about Selenium. You can get to his website at eriwen.com. Thank you, Eric. We appreciate it.
Yep, oh, thanks, Eric. You again.
All right. Thank you. All right. So that was actually fun. We recorded that with Eric. Super nice guy. I want to thank him for giving us that little overview of Selenium. And it's really fun. So the next thing we want to talk about is a little life hacker article we found called Essential Tools for Starting Your Side Business.
Okay.
You know, Mark and I, we always talk about, we are really into entrepreneurship and small businesses and things like that. So the first item is Get Physical. They said you may be running your side business out of your home, but you can still get yourself a separate business address without actually leasing an office. So for really cheap, you can get that. You can get, you know, either, you know, a PO box or another actual, you know, mailing address.
Mm-hmm.
And you then you don't have to give you don't have to run everything out of your home. It really can mean a lot to a person to see that you're not running something out of an apartment building.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, so it's basically saying get a PO box.
Get a PO box, or with some of these, it's like kind of a small space for freelancers to do that. So you can still get like packages delivered there if you want and stuff. But yeah, like a PO box works. Or for this one, you know, some of these actually have like small office spaces and stuff that you can like sign up a time for. So let's say instead of having an office all the time, you just say, I need this for an hour, and then you can, you know, hold meetings and stuff.
And they recommend getting a separate phone number, and a good way to do that is Google Voice number. And we talked about that. It's, unfortunately, right now it's invite only still. But.
Yeah, exactly. But get, and then that way you don't have to give out your cell phone number and have clients calling you at 3 a.m. on the weekends. It's not a good idea.
Definitely, I definitely recommend getting a separate number, and that's a very inexpensive way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they release it.
Or if you need fax, they mention their services like eFax and things like that that can help. Basically, give more physicality to your business. It seems kind of shady, but, you know, apparent physicality to your business. But at least give you the business tools you need, like a separate phone number, a separate address, so that you're not mixing your house and your business up too much, because that can lead to a lot of trouble.
Yeah, the e-fax, like that's a good tip, because a lot of businesses are still using fax, and you give them a certain number, and goes your email.
Yeah. The second tip is make your one essential hire an accountant. A lot of small businesses try to skimp by and things like that. And an accountant is an important thing.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have an accountant doing your day-to-day accounting, have an accountant that is, you know, that you have established a business relationship with, for even consulting, like, you know, should I make an LLC or an S corp? I mean, that's a great example. You should consult an accountant for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard other people say that, you know, your other essential hire should be a lawyer, maybe. But this one says, you know, this article says at least get an accountant. And you don't, you know, it doesn't have to be as expensive, because like I said, you don't have to pay them to do your day-to-day books. But you need an accountant when things come like tax time, and you need to have someone you can call to say, hey, I'm making a decision, which is better for my taxes, which is better for my books.
One of the number one expenses in your life is taxes.
Oh, yeah.
So accountants can find ways to save you money on your taxes. So a lot of times they pay for themselves.
Yeah. If you recognize that expense, it's one of those things where people are like, well, I pay this much for an accountant, they haven't saved me any money. But you need to look at all the expenses they save you money with. So.
All right. The next one, we got establish your business presence online and off. We mentioned having, you know, business cards printed off.
Yep.
You know, even if you do most of your business online, you should probably have something to give out. I know.
Yeah. And I mean, like if it is your business, like if you have a car or something, I mean, get a little sticker made or something with a logo on the back of your car, so that, you know, it gives you more cred, more street cred, I guess, for your business. But,
and you're going to find yourself in a situation where you're going to want to talk, you know, give out a card. I mean, we were at a social event not too long ago, and somebody asked for a card and was, well, we don't really have one right now.
Yeah, exactly. And or, you know, if you're like, this is about establishing a side business, you know, you don't want to hand out the business card that your employer paid for your side business. That will get you in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and like if you have a website, at least get some website with a splash page with contact information. Don't say coming soon. Don't say under construction. Just get a splash page, you know, with your logo, contact information, so that, you know, because I do it. The first thing I do with any small business I see is I want to go see their webpage immediately. I Google them immediately.
Yep.
You got to have that.
Yeah, if anything, to secure the name.
Yeah.
You know, because later on, you're going to have, if you, you know, get larger, you know, your business is more successful, you're going to want a website anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's lots of ways that you can easily host. Like this one said, there's really a lot of ways to easily host your domain where you don't even have to. I mean, you and I pay pretty decent money for a good, you know, web host. But you can buy just the domain and have it forward to like a, you know, even a, you know, Google WordPress site, URL, Google site, exactly.
Yep.
Really easily.
Yep.
All right, the next is distribute your goods. Yeah, I mean, it's important. There's a lot of different ways to do it. It depends on your good, of course. If your good is consulting, then, you know, get out and get some customers. You got to hit the street. You got to make connections. You got to find those people you want. Mm-hmm. If you're actually trying to sell a product, then, you know, get ready and start sending your stuff out. Like they mentioned, you know, if you want to sell T-shirts or mugs, you can use things like Cafe Press, which yep. I would not recommend Cafe Press, though. They use the crappiest quality stuff ever. Did your they? T-shirts, the printing on your T-shirt will fall apart in like a week.
Amazon's a good one, though. They're listening here. Yeah. Amazon, if you're selling books, ebooks, I know they've got used things, all kinds of stuff you can sell through Amazon.
Yeah. And Amazon, eBay, there's buy.com merchants now where... You know, you put up the items you have for sale through someone like buy.com or Amazon, and then when someone searches for the product, if you have a lower price, that kind of comes up first. It says, hey, well, you won't buy this from this merchant at a lower price. It'll even come up before Amazon's own stuff. And I'm sure they take a small cut or something. They but, do. You know, I've bought from these places on like buy.com and Amazon, and if they ship fast, I don't even really notice a difference in the transaction at all.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. The next step is wrangle your paperwork. And this is, oh man, paperwork can kill a small business, especially if you have a significant other. Your paperwork can kind of get all over the house. But, I mean, you need to realize if you're starting a business, you have to keep better records than, you know, even just your home finances. I mean, you really should keep good records of your home finances, but...
they make a good example here is to scan all your documents and get them digital right away.
Yeah.
And you don't have to wait. You know, it's easier to search through digital content than it is paper content.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then...
easier, you know, it takes up less space, too.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you make sure you're going to go all digital, then, like... Mark on NicksTutor.com recently had a really good article about how to do offsite backups with a friend. So if you have a friend that's also starting a small business, you can do offsite backups there. Because if you do all digital, you got to make sure you have it safe. Because if you scan it and throw it away and then your hard drive crashes, you're in trouble. But there's definitely a lot of tools out there for guys like that.
Yeah, I mean, get yourself a cheap document scanner or something. Scan those receipts in, scan all that stuff in. Get everything digital as much as possible.
Yeah, and they made some suggestions on here to use online tools for tracking time and invoices and stuff. And we just talked about a great web app to do that with less accounting. So make sure that you have a system like that. And the good thing about something like less accounting is it is designed for small side businesses. So, you know, someone like me with a small business, I get into QuickBooks, and QuickBooks has a lot more features than I'll ever need. And it can be daunting. You're like, well, should I use this? You know, something like less accounting, you can look at it and say, like, well, if it has these features, then perhaps I need to look at my business process to see if I need to incorporate these, because a lot of other people are. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is manage your customers. And this is, managing your customer contacts and managing your satisfaction. Like, hey, they have a big picture of the Get Satisfaction logo on there using like Get Satisfaction or User Voice.
We talked about those before. They're just web apps that allow the users to submit feedback and things a lot easier than just like a custom homebrew one.
Yeah.
And it's social driven too. They can vote on which features they think that should be improved and mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah, a lot of businesses don't leverage feedback enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of one of those people where, I mean, when I get a receipt and Target says, there's a survey online, go fill it. I'm like, you know, yeah, right. Yay. But, you know, when I'm doing business to business stuff with other people and they call back and say, hey, how did this work? That puts them leaps and bounds above other people.
Yeah.
To, you know, even if you send a custom email to an older customer and say, here's a link to Get Satisfaction, but make it personal and say like, right. I was really wondering what, you know, you think the next sort of features or services we should offer are. So here's a link to check it out and let me know. Thank you. I appreciate it. That's, you know. You're professional right there. You're looking really good in their eyes. So,
yeah, a good example of that is Netflix sends out emails saying, "Hey, did the CD arrive?" And
so. Yeah,
yeah, annoying. It's over time. I mean,
they're good about making it random, though.
Yeah, they don't do it every movie. Right.
It's not everything I watch online, but randomly, and they make it really easy. I don't even have to log in to vote on those. Yep, I just click the link, and they say, "Hey, thanks for your feedback." And it's simple, fast, and I feel like it makes me feel like they care. You know, like I'm customer one out of a billion, but you know, you at least are recording what I'm saying.
Yep.
It's good stuff. This, we'll put the article in the show notes. There's also a lot of research, resources on here. They have like a lot of Twitter people and things that they said on Twitter you might want to follow and check out. So take a look at it. But just remember, if you're going to start a side business, it's not something you should be taking, you should take very lightly. And almost always, like, the amount of success you have just depends on how much, you know, how much time and effort you put into it to make sure that you go out there and crank it and work hard, even though it's a side business. And that's the hard part, because you're saying, I'm working 40 hours a week, plus you want me to try and do the side business. Well, then maybe if that's too much for you, you shouldn't be starting a side business. You should think it over a little bit. But
I just want to admit one thing before we close on this one is I just saw an interesting comment here. Data entry, you know, a lot of times if it's not data centric, you can throw it up on Mechanical Turk and you can get much cheaper and faster data entry.
Yeah. You know, that's a good call. Things. There's services like that. Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's going to have to be, you know, non-sensitive data, but.
Mm-hmm. But that's cool.
Can, I mean, this guy was saying it saved him a ton of time.
Yeah. So that's a really good point.
Yeah, leverage.
There's lots of things like that. So check out this article. There's a lot of resources on there, and it'll be in the show notes for you. All right. So the next thing we want to talk about is an article called 10 Skills Developers Will Need in the Next 5 Years. So, Mark, what are some of the things that I will need in the next 10 years?
Well, the first one is, you know, the big three languages that are the most popular, I would say, in the business realm, .NET, Java, and PHP. Now, you know, we talked about Rails and different languages are starting to take off. Although, I mean, most sites right now are done in these three languages. I mean, they're not going away.
Yeah. Yeah, they're big.
It does mention, you know, you should, you know, check out the frameworks that are associated with them. But yeah, those are the big three.
So .NET, Java, and PHP, it's just a good thing to know at least one of them.
Yeah. Rich internet applications, this is, you know, stuff like Flex, Ajax, HTML5, all that stuff.
Gotta learn that stuff.
It says, you know, the first sentence is love it or hate it. It's going to be there. Yeah. I mean, we both are kind of like, you know, some of this stuff, I mean, we know it's there. We see the need for a lot of this stuff. But at the same time, it's like, I don't like writing that kind of code, or I don't like doing that stuff.
Yeah. The unfortunate but it's gonna be part, there. Yeah, is it's really easy to sell. I mean, it really is easy to sell. You show someone a flat web page that looks pretty, they're like, ooh, that looks nice. You show someone like a wicked awesome Ajax thing or a flash animation that's got, you know, flying lights and stuff everywhere, and they're just like, you know.
Yeah.
Just amazed.
You know, it's easy to get carried away with it, for sure. But yeah,
and I hope the ability of it to sell won't influence developers to just push it for the sake of selling, because it's just one of those trends that I think is not best for the industry in the long term.
Mm-hmm. The next one I definitely agree on, which is web development. If you're a programmer, it doesn't matter if you're mainly like this desktop application publisher or something, you're going to need to know web development because a lot of these apps deal with the web. And a lot of them, I think we're going to see a big shift where a lot of the programs are going to be done over the web, web apps instead of a desktop one.
Yeah.
So as a programmer, you should definitely learn web development, you know, CSS, JavaScript.
Yeah, the basics. I mean, there's a lot of programmers that can program wicked stuff, but they can't give you a I've seen programmers come out with some really cool back-end stuff, but then give you a page that has, you know, like scrolling marquees in it.
Yeah, and I mean,
which aren't even compliant anymore.
On the outside, HTML and CSS looks like super duper easy, like XML, you know, super easy. But there's a lot of tricks to the trade,
yeah,
so to speak. CSS can be, you know, a difficult thing to master, I guess. It's easy to get started, but there's certain tricks and certain things
to do it right.
To do it right. To have cross compatibility, to do it right. I mean, it takes some time to learn CSS.
Well, and if you're a programmer that comes from a compiling desktop, you know, a compiling language, you know, they're a lot more strict about what they'll let you do. You know, you'll get compile errors. I've seen a lot of people who've done desktop programming and then come into the web realm, and they're they're always like, well, what happened? I didn't, you know, they're used to getting compile errors when things go wrong, and it doesn't happen like that. You know, that's why we have to do a lot of things like unit testing, and mm-hmm. You and I are trying to encourage people to do things like that a lot more because it is so easy. It sets more boundaries for you. And like CSS is a great example. You can do CSS, but you might not be doing it right in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you might be causing yourself a lot more work than you ever thought would happen.
Definitely. The next one's on the same line. You know, the desktop publishers are used to using COM and ODBC to interact with their programs, like the API part of it. But I've even seen the desktop apps are starting to use XML to mess with the API with mm-hmm. them. It's just easier, and the web services definitely are using it. All the APIs that I use on the web is either XML or JSON.
Yeah. So number four is web services. They're talking about REST or SOAP, JSON and XML. And it's great because web apps almost inherently work that way, and a lot more desktop applications are making it easily integratable with these web services because they become so standard and easy. I mean, we use a lot of JSON at work, and I'm always like, wow, it's just so cool what you can pass along a regular HTTP connection. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. The next one is soft skills. This is going to be like, the human, talking with people. I think this one's a running theme. I think you're going to always need this kind of stuff.
But if you want to make it now, you can't be that curmudgeon-y programmer in the corner who doesn't talk to people and just does brilliant stuff.
Right.
It's all about collaborating. I mean, the programming business world is moving towards teams, collaboration, a lot of telecommuting, which, you have to have people skills to telecommute, even if they're just electronic people skills. But and it just seems a lot more that if you can't get along with people, they don't want. There's been a lot of studies recently. I've seen a couple that said that the bad apple can really ruin the whole team. So a lot of companies aren't even going to take the chance of hiring someone that they think might ruin everyone else's productivity. It doesn't matter how productive they are. If they kill the rest of the team, they're worthless.
Definitely. And a lot of you see a lot more team based stuff anyway, nowadays anyways.
So. Yeah, exactly. It's all over the place. All right. Number six, learn one dynamic and or functional programming language.
Yeah, you see a lot more instead of just this, you see a lot more agile kind of stuff like Ruby, Python's getting popular. They're saying use stuff like that, like frameworks.
Yeah. Everything's an object in Ruby. I mean, it's really flexible. It's really dynamic. It changes a lot really quickly. It's got a very active community that's, PHP has a huge community, but the community doesn't really get to, add much to PHP. It's pretty, their release cycle and stuff is pretty steady. Ruby is, there's like Ruby, there's the RailsCon, which is like huge Ruby cons and stuff. And they'll, it's like a lot of the big developers are in there helping shape the language, and it changes a lot, which is difficult to a programmer at first, but it creates it keeps it really fresh and really new.
Okay, yeah, and the next one ties in there. Number seven is agile stuff that like Rails. You get a lot of times, we see this in projects where. I want this feature, and then all of a sudden they're saying, "Oh, we don't want that feature. We want this." And
yeah.
By learning an agile, by learning these methodologies, you kind of take that natural human characteristic of saying, "Oh, I like that feature. I want more of that or this." Mm-hmm. That once you adopt that a little bit, you can actually change your programming on the fly a little bit faster than if you were not to use that.
So, yeah, I actually
and languages, the dynamic languages like Ruby and Python are making that easy for us.
Yeah, I actually have two books here at home on agile methodologies that I really need to read for work because we're, we've at work we've kind of said that we are doing the agile methodology for a while, but we really, you can't just say that you're doing the agile, doing agile programming methodology and then just kind of. It's not easier. It's just as strict as every other programming methodology. It's just a different way of doing it that's more flexible. And so I think, we kind of got into the trap of saying, oh, we're doing agile stuff, which is to us basically meant, we kind of do our work as it comes and kind of get it going. But we're trying to right now make sure we kind of get into a little more strict agile methodology so that we can, because we're doing research programming for, NIH grants and stuff for like actual researchers across the country. So it needs to be flexible, and we have to be able to do things on the fly really quick. So it fits with us really well.
Yeah. The next one is domain knowledge. This is, you see a lot of times that projects can get fragmented, mm-hmm. and a programmer will be working on his little thing, and this other guy will be working on this other deal, and they're not actually looking at the larger picture. So sometimes they might like totally not go in the right direction just because they're focused on their little task at hand. And so I think a lot of the projects now are trying to integrate more of the what this is actually about.
Yeah.
Kind of stuff.
Or like one chunk of the program, you know, someone divided the two chunks of the programs. You got one program over here working on some, one program working on the other. But if they are able to look at the whole big picture, they might say like, well, these two chunks should not be separate. They would work a lot better together. Or, oh, well, let's do this a different way. I mean, a lot of times this sort of top-heavy stuff, where it gets chunked down as it filters down through all the levels, creates a lot of inefficiency. Mm-hmm. And if you give programmers the big picture, it's difficult at first. I mean, a lot of these things we're talking about, it's difficult to implement because it's different than what people are doing right now. But they might be able to look at the problem as a whole and come up with a better solution overall. Because, I mean, a lot of programmers, that's their job, is to solve problems. Mm-hmm.
The next one's development hygiene. This kind of stuff is like, their example was Code Cowboys, the programmers that store everything on their personal USB drive. And, you know, you need to be able to.
Best practices, man. Yeah. I am a huge best practices freak, and I'm trying to do the same thing at work right now. You have to use version control.
Yep.
You have to use things like bug tracking software. You have to use things like, I mean, programmers do not want to document. This is a problem I have ran into so much, and it's like, and it's hard to convince people to do it, but you have got to make your programmer document things properly. You have to do you have to do some sort of testing and quality control cycles. It's just coding has been really loose, except for like, you know, like we talked with Eric Wendelin earlier, you know, a lot of the big shops have been doing this and enforcing this for a while, but now it's become so cheap and easy for little guys to do it that they really need to.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I love best practices. I love trying to think of things like workflows and systems to implement stuff like that. It gets me so excited.
Yeah. I mean, another example they give here is like a virtual machine for testing, you know. It makes things so much faster, easier to just revert changes and.
So, I mean, look at your workflow, get good processes in place and look at it. And even the smallest development shop can pump out software that's just as good and just as clean and professional as the big pros.
Yep.
No problem.
Yep. Just always be checking to see if there's a better way to do it or.
You know,
see what everybody else is doing.
Yeah,
and check out like, the best, like you said, the best practices.
Yeah, like we said, it's hard. I mean, I've seen a couple programmers at work where, you know, we introduce Subversion to them, and it is tough. But once they use it and realize what it is, it becomes invaluable to them. I would never, ever, ever think of programming without some sort of Subversion repository right now. Absolutely not. Even if I'm not collaborating with someone else, the fact that I can, you know, or Git would be a perfect situation for that, you know, to use Git for my own personal repository, because I want to look at versions, I want to branch. Yep. You need that. You need those tools, and you have to have them.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. The next one is mobile development. I mean, this one should be obvious to most people.
Yeah. I mean, the power of the iPhone. I mean, it's just revolutionized. The second it outsold the Razr.
We've got netbooks coming out with smaller screens. We've got iPod, you know, like the iPod Touch. We've got the iPhone, you know. Everything's going mobile.
You can't buy a smartphone from Verizon right now without getting a data plan with it. They said now they're just like, that's stupid. We're not going to do that anymore. Yep. So think about it. Try and get some mobile versions of anything, at least if it's in some capacity. Because when I go to a non-mobile version on my Windows mobile smartphone, it hurts.
Yep. Yeah, consider checking out the CSS ways to make the screen, you know, space smaller. Maybe learn is it Objective-C for iPod,
mm-hmm.
the iPod or the iPhone. Or, you know, check out any of the APIs from Google for the Android phone.
Yeah.
Any of that mobile stuff. Definitely check that out.
And just at least look at it. Like you said, you can get an Android emulator.
Yep. You don't need these devices to program the actual programs. So.
And just check it out. I mean, let's say think about if you were going to this web page with your old Pentium 133 with, like, you know, because, I mean, that's basically what these phones are anymore. Mm-hmm. Your old Pentium 133 with, you know, X megs of RAM.
Yeah.
Think about how that would load on your website, and then think, well, okay, maybe I can create a mobile version. I mean, you don't even have to use these. Like, if you use the iPhone web API, it's going to be very specific to iPhone. But you can just make a stripped-down mobile version that does fairly simple stuff, and it makes it a lot easier for people.
Yeah, you're going to have to get creative because your screen size is definitely a lot smaller.
Oh, I know. I see with my netbook all the time. That was a great example. I didn't even think of that, but yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have to get creative in how you lay out the data, you know, the stuff, and the text, and
yeah, I think, was it last episode I talked about now that Ustream's broadcast window is too big for my netbook?
Oh, really?
And it's like, you know, if they put a little more thought into it, you know.
Well, they just recently did a new design. Have you tried it since?
Yeah.
No, it's still broken.
Yep. All right. Well, that about does it for this episode of Face Off. Again, I want to thank Eric Wendelin for coming on the show. That was awesome. Again, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to our show via faceoffshow.com/feed. You can if you have suggestions or comments, you can email us, studio@faceoffshow.com. Send us a reply on Twitter or just comment on our website. We'd love to hear from our viewers. We love any suggestions. There's been a couple times now where we found out that we were wrong, and we're slowly trying to rectify those mistakes. We actually hope in the near future to have a Flex expert come and straighten us out on that, because we were not right, Mark Sandvard.
Nope.
So,
And if you want to follow Eric Wendelin, he's EM Wendelin on Twitter, twitter.com/EM Wendelin.
Yeah, we'll put all those links in the show notes so you can check him out and follow him. He's a great guy, so we appreciate him for coming on the show. And we'll see you guys next week.